owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. If I were to ask you which organization has a higher percentage of women serving, the United States Congress or the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency? Well, you might be wrong. It's the U.S. Congress. It's estimated that a mere 15% of federal law enforcement roles are filled by women. I guess you could say that our guest today was somewhat of a trailblazer. Whether it be military or law enforcement, you have to know that the person next to you or behind you has your back. And yet, despite excelling in many aspects of her profession, she still encountered resistance. One of her fellow agents even told her, and I quote, "Our job can only be done by white men." Luckily for us, she carried on, busting bad guys and protecting us. Cynthia Beebe was one of the first women special agents for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and spent 27 years working to arrest and convict some of the worst of the worst. Her rather storied career is told in the book Boots in the Ashes, and today we're very, very pleased to have her join us on American Warrior Radio. Cynthia Beebe, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, Ben.
Well, it's going to be a kick, Cynthia. It's going to be a wild ride.
I'm looking forward to it.
Now, Cynthia, the ATF is a relatively young agency separating from the Internal Revenue Service in 1972. Can I still call you a revenuer, or is that too old school?
I think that's old school at this point.
Okay, fair enough. Now, just for our listeners, give us sort of a broad outline, Cynthia, of ATF's primary mission set.
ATF is designed and almost exclusively enforces crimes against violent criminals. About 85% of our cases are related to guns and illegal firearms and gangs. Like I said, it's primarily about felons, convicted felons, and violent criminals. We also investigate bombings and arsons, again, but the underlying point is to arrest violent criminals.
Okay, let's set the background here a little bit about Cynthia. You grew up somewhat of a tomboy in a suburb just north of Chicago, and I found it interesting in reading your book, Cynthia. I love this quote. You said, you know, good guys were always boys, and you know, particularly on TV. And you didn't aspire to this kind of career. It wasn't even an option, really, growing up for most women, was it at that time?
That's correct. I grew up in the 1960s, and I had an older brother, and we would watch, you know, The Lone Ranger and Batman and so on and so forth. But there really weren't any shows, or in real life, there really weren't women police officers or women federal agents. And it just really didn't even occur to me as a possible career.
Now, along comes Title IX, which really changed your life, and that was... Well, I guess also in 1972, wasn't it?
Yes, Richard Nixon signed Title IX into law in 1972. That's correct.
Interesting. A couple of things happened. Title IX and ATF separated from the IRS. So that might have been a sign. And I love you said that doors were open for the first time and I didn't walk through. I ran through them full speed ahead. I love that about you.
Thank you very much. And I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. When Title IX passed, I was able to take advantage of how high school sports opened up for women. I was able to play 4 years of varsity sports at high school, and I was able to get a full athletic scholarship to Northwestern University, only maybe the second or third year that Northwestern offered scholarships for women. So I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time.
Now, Cynthia, you mentioned, or we talked earlier, that this really wasn't never considered as a career. And I found it interesting. You early on, I think when you were in college, you did meet a female FBI agent, but you didn't pursue the FBI because you. Why?
Well, you're right. It was I was out of college by the time I met the female female FBI agent, and she explained to me how federal law enforcement agencies worked. I'd never heard of ATF, for example. And she said at that time, the FBI was notorious for transferring agents all over the country, all over the time. And that kind of put me off. I didn't really want to be transferred God knows where and God knows when. But I'd heard about ATF, and I knew that they investigated bomb and arson and guns. But bomb and arson really piqued my interest. And they were at that time known for not transferring people, agents against their will, and I decided to apply for ATF.
Now, your career, it's, and again, folks, get the book Boots and Ashes. It's really a great read. And I find your path not disjointed, because clearly, Cynthia, once you set your mind on something, I mean, you go after it. And that is, no kidding, that's reflected in your career. And I believe that's, I don't believe in the book, it pretty much says that's a lot of the reason you were successful. But so you took the test. ATF said, Cynthia, we'd love to have you. We're going to pay you a bajillion dollars or something like that.
Yeah. I don't know about that, but okay. They did say, yeah, they'd hire me. Yeah.
Now, what was interesting to me was, though, you talked about not moving, but really, as I understand it, your option at that point in time was to be the only female ATF agent in St. Paul or not be an agent at all.
That's correct. I was offered the job in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I'm from the Chicago area, and I did think about it. But having said that, I had been to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I thought it was a great town, and it wasn't all that far from Chicago, where my parents lived. And I realized that I was either going to take the job then and there, or I would never be offered the job again. It's not like some careers where you might have a second chance. I knew it was now or never. And I decided to go ahead and give it a try. So I went ahead on up to Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Now, I always, and you'll see, Cynthia, Ben gets a couple of dumb questions every chat, but I was surprised to learn that, you know, normally there's a natural progression. You interview, you take the test, et cetera, they offer you the job, and then right away, you're sent to training. Your route, though, was sort of, I started off with kind of some on-the-job training, right, before you actually went to the more advanced academies. In fact, I think your first case, you weren't even able to carry a weapon yet officially.
That's right. And that was because ATF underwent a massive hiring boom around 1985, 1986, 1987. I was hired in 1987. ATF had been cut down in size for 2 or 3 years. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, Congress decided we really want to beef up ATF and gave ATF a lot of money to hire new agents. And there were so many new agents that there weren't spots for us down at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy. So we first reported to our home office and worked there until there was space for us at the academy. That's right.
Now, Cynthia, I believe that things happen for a reason. And it's interesting to me that very first case in St. Paul for you just happened to be an arson investigation, and that really set the scene for a lot of the rest of your career. And in many ways, that I'm guessing that's where the title of your book, Boots in the Ashes, came from.
You're exactly right. It did, from arson and also bomb scenes, which can often result in fires. But yes, I actually was staying with friends in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I drove to work every day, obviously, and one day I drove by a corner grocery store that wasn't more than maybe a mile from where I was staying, and it looked like the windows had been blown out, and it all looked very odd, and there was crime scene tape. And I remember walking to the store or going into the office and thinking to myself, my gosh, it looked like a bomb blew up in there. And long story short, it turned out that the owner had intentionally torched the building for the insurance money. And my senior officer, who I was assigned to at that time, was assigned to investigate that case as an arson. And I went along with him, and I learned so much about working arsons right then and there near where I was staying at that corner grocery store arson.
Cynthia, we're going to have to take a break real quick, but sort of let me leave you with this question, something I learned from your book. You know, if I walk up, I'm a law enforcement official, and I walk up on a crime scene and there's a body there, you know, with a bullet wound between their eyes, I'm pretty sure I've got a murder. But with arson, it's unique in that you first have to prove that the fire was arson before you even begin investigating the bad guys. I want to talk more about that when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Very pleased to be joined by Cynthia Beebe, one of the very first female ATF agents. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Cynthia Beebe. Cynthia is, I don't want to say she's a rule breaker, but she certainly had a very storied career in the ATF. 27 years, she's got a great book called Boots in the Ashes. We're talking a little bit about that. Cynthia, before we took the break, I sort of teased. I never thought of it this way, but when it comes to arsons, you first have to determine whether there was a crime committed and not just an accident, right?
That's correct. In fact, we have specialists. ATF has specialists, cause and origin specialists. Now they're called origin and cause specialists, but who come in to any fire scene where there's a question, and they, along with other agents, can spend anywhere from minutes to hours to days trying to determine whether or not the scene shows evidence of a crime, in other words, shows the fact that the fire was intentionally set by a human being. And there are specialists with ATF and state fire marshals. Some of the bigger cities have fire cause and origin experts as well.
Now, Cynthia, what was it about that crime scene, that insurance fraud crime scene, that really sort of wet your whistle to consider pursuing this as one of your specialties throughout the rest of your career?
First of all, I was lucky enough to have the senior agent I was working with, but also the Minneapolis Fire Department guys, arson investigators, could not have been any nicer. And they were very patient with me. They lent me helmets and boots, and they took their time. They had high-intensity flashlights because there was no power, obviously, in this blackened, soggy, crumpled up store, and they took their time and they explained to me how they were reading the fire scene, how they were able to trace what the arsonist did, what the signs were, and the fact that these firefighters were so thoughtful and patient with me, a brand new ATF agent, really made a big difference. And from that moment on, I loved working with firefighters for the rest of my career.
Well, it might have had something to do with you also, for the rest of your career, started showing up on crime scenes with donuts.
Yeah, yes, that's true. Whenever I had the chance, when I was driving to a crime scene where I knew there would be multiple agents and multiple police officers and firefighters, if I could, if I saw an open Dunkin' Donuts or donut shop, I'd always stop and get at least a dozen donuts because I knew, you know, investigators were always hungry, and at times we could go hours without food. And this was long before Starbucks and, you know, there were corner shops everywhere. So I always tried to make a point of, you know, bringing some donuts.
Well, little things make a big difference. Now, Cynthia, the transition or the connection between arson and bombing, is that, I don't think that, for me, that's not a natural one, but to clarify, in your line of work, it really is?
Well, they both tend to be complex investigations, quite often bombings will result in a fire. So even though the underlying cause of the fire is a bomb, the arson investigators have to be able to determine that. So for that reason, the bomb and arson quite often do go together. But the fact that they were more complex investigations, not that some gun investigations aren't very complex as well, don't get me wrong, but bomb and arson investigations tended to be, usually there was one or two bad guys. And for whatever reason, I was able to do quite well in that field. Both those crimes interested me enormously, and that was my specialty.
Now, Cynthia, I want to get a little bit more into that because I think I was somewhat reading between the lines of your book, Boots in the Ashes, or it may be because Laura and I just love to binge watch Investigation Discovery, but I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. You are still a young agent. You finally do get to the ATF Academy, and you're a competitor. You excel in what you do. And let's talk about the name or the title Top Gun.
Yeah, I was, even from the time I was a little girl, I was a competitive athlete, and I was blessed with good hand-eye coordination. And down at the academy, we had obviously had to learn to shoot and shoot well. And at the end of every academy class, there was a major award called the Top Gun Award, which would go to the best shot in the class. And it had never been won by a woman before at the ATF Academy. And the day of the Top Gun shoot came, and there were several very good shots in the class. And I just assumed going into it that whoever won that day was going to shoot a perfect target, because there were quite a few of us, including me, who on occasion shot a perfect target. But I wanted to give it my best shot, pun intended there. For that particular day, even though we did have some experienced police officers who were very good shots, I was able to win the award. I shot a 98 out of 100, so it was not a perfect target. But I was genuinely surprised that I won. And thankfully for me, the guys who were the favorites, so to speak, could not have been nicer to me. They were just great. And that night when we went out for beers, which we did most nights, I didn't have to pay for a single beer, and I knew that it was okay.
Nice. Now, yeah. As I understand it, Cynthia, though, you didn't grow up hunting and trapping and shooting. Weapons, firearms were a relatively new thing for you at the time.
Oh, yeah. I think I'd only shot a gun, a handgun, once or twice. I had taken a brief riflery class in college, but I had good instructors down at the academy, and trust me, we shot all the time. We shot thousands and thousands of rounds while we were at the academy. But I do think it was first that I was a very competitive athlete, and also shooting, it's all front sight and trigger control, which, you know, was drilled into our brains. And I was able to control my nerves and concentrate on front sight and trigger control. And that day, I was able to shoot very well.
Well, I tell you, Cynthia, I will echo that. My wife doesn't like loud noises. And so the first time I took her to the range, I was a little concerned. We're shooting .45 caliber at 21 feet. Her first two rounds were center X. I took the weapon back from her and prohibited her from ever going shooting with me again. There's a theme throughout your career and throughout the book, Cynthia, about some of the resistance you faced, particularly from the other male agents. But was there grumblings on the range or was that the first, look, fellas, I can do it just as good as you can moment, or a little bit of both?
Well, there was, I had some resistance at the range, more so when I transferred back to Chicago. Chicago was a much bigger office. There were well over 100 agents by then. And when I got to Chicago, out of the 7 or 8 women, out of about 125 or 130 agents at the time, I was the best shot among the women. And there were a handful of guys who did not expect that. No one knew me coming in from Minneapolis, St. Paul. And when I went out there and shot quite well, I think I cleaned the target a couple times, there was some chatter about that, and it took some getting used to for some of the guys.
Cynthia, my father, who was a minister, and for us, you know, weapons were just like a chainsaw or an axe. They were just tools. But I'll never forget, and keep in mind, this is coming from a minister. He always taught me and my brothers, you never point at something unless you intend to shoot it, and you never shoot unless you intend to kill. There is a recurring mentor in your story, a fellow named Jeff, and some of the first advice he gave you was 3 points about gunfights. Share with our listeners what those were.
Yes, Jeff was an experienced agent and just the nicest guy in the whole world. This was up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, who liked me very much. I liked him, and he took me under his wing. And one day he sat me down and very seriously, and he wasn't normally a real serious guy, and he said, "Now listen, Cindy, you have not been a street cop before, and there are 3 rules that you have to learn." And I don't know if I've got them in order here from one in the book, but he said, the first is, it's better to have a gun and not need it than it is to need a gun and not have it. And he second rule was, in a gunfight, you want to be the firstest with the mostest. And the third rule was, it's better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6. And those three rules stuck in my brain for the rest of my career. And obviously, they're still in my mind now. And what helped me was Jeff was so intent and so serious, and he wanted me to be able to take care of myself on the street. And I really deeply appreciated that.
Cynthia, when we come back, I want to, we'll get into a little bit some of his other advice. You know, a lot of us have heard the you know, better to be tried by 12 than carried by 6. But many of us, most of us, me included, have never heard the advice, always get the kitchen. When we come back, I want to talk about another part of your career, the Secret Service protection. And also, I want to do some deep dive into the psychology of some of these bad guys that you've tracked down. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Cynthia Beebe. She is a former ATF agent, 27 years. Great book, Books, Boots in the Ashes. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking with Cynthia Beebe. Cynthia is, still is a great person. 27 years as an ATF agent, really broke down, kicked in a lot of barriers as a woman in the ATF early in her career. She's got a great book out called Boots in the Ashes. Cynthia, I want to talk a little bit, kind of do a deep dive here. There's some really intriguing characters in your book, and by I use the air quotes, characters are not fictional characters. They're people you actually encountered, investigated, and helped to prosecute. The first one that really attracted me, I guess maybe in a weird way of saying that, in a scary way, was Lauren Bell Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant, but mentally disturbed.
Yes, I investigated him. I was still quite a young agent in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And there had been two bombings about a year apart, powerful homemade bombs of two different state judges in southern Minnesota. And our explosives experts were certain that it was the same manufacturer because, first of all, there's signatures in the bombs. But in addition to the ANFO, the part of the ANFO, the bomber used kerosene instead of diesel fuel, for example, and kerosene is very, very rarely used in these bombs. So our explosives experts, technical experts, were certain it was the same guy. And I was the second or third agent brought onto the case because the prime suspect was a man named Lauren Bell Richard, who there were also state and local investigators actively involved in this case, but he was clearly mentally ill in some capacity. He had never been evaluated. No one knew exactly what his diagnosis was, but he had spent several years writing absolutely vitriolic letters and postcards and threats to not just these two judges, but to CEOs of businesses and to anyone who made him angry, other judges where he had encountered them. But because of his mental illness, a couple of the agents, a couple of the investigators really kind of stayed at a distance. They just didn't really want to investigate him a whole lot. But I was an English major in college, and I was used to reading and analyzing large volumes of texts. And he had written over 250 threatening postcards and letters. And I was willing and able to take all 250 of those and analyze them and put them in order. And at any rate, I quickly became convinced that Lauren Bell Richard was the bomber, and I went after him.
Now, just Cynthia, just to clarify, earlier in the interviews, you said long story short. We're all about telling great stories, so feel free to go short story long. This guy is fascinating in that, and just to back up a little bit, many of our listeners are technical experts, but explain to people ANFO. What does that stand for?
Oh, sorry. Ammonium nitrate fuel oil. It's a very common, simple method of making an explosive. You can make it in your backyard. Farmers used to use it all the time for well over 100 years to clear stumps out of farmland. Unfortunately, the Oklahoma City bomb mm-hmm. was just a massive, massive info bomb. But a lot of homemade bombs that aren't pipe bombs are info bombs.
Now, you mentioned that the kerosene. So often, is it true that so often with these bombers, there's sort of a unique signature that they leave behind? And in his case, it was the kerosene versus diesel fuel?
Yes, and certainly when you start to get a serial bomber. Plus, for example, he left the location where he placed the bomb at both judges' house. It was right next to the back door, and the same time of night. The methodology just screamed to me and to the explosives techs that, yes, this is the same guy. And Lauren Bell Richard's motivation was very strong. It came across to me very clear in his writings. And I ended up taking my investigation. I was the first agent in Minneapolis-St. Paul to take my investigation and my evidence and consult with the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, which is better known as the FBI Behavioral Sciences Lab. And it was new at that time. And I was, the first ATF agent in Minneapolis-St. Paul and one of the first in the country to take a case there. And that changed my life and my career because I had encountered some pushback in my office in St. Paul about Lauren Bell Richard being the bad guy. Some people thought he was too crazy to be the bad guy. But in the time I was at the NCAVC, I worked with 6 or 7 very experienced, very smart investigators. They weren't just FBI agents. They were state and locals from all over and other federal agencies. They all agreed with my analysis of the crime. They were all certain Bell Richard was the bomber. They all agreed that my plan going forward was the right one. And their belief in my analysis of the crime helped me, not just in that case, but for the rest of my career.
Cynthia, one thing I've observed in watching these documentaries, particularly about serial criminals, is so often one of the common threads I see, and I don't know if this applies to Mr. Bell Richard, but maybe it does, they're very intelligent, and then they sort of develop this certain level of arrogance where, you know, they're sitting there in the interview, the interrogation, and they just know that they're smarter than you. Did you see that with Richard or?
With Lauren Bell Richard, it was very interesting. I ended up interviewing him 3 times, and he was so mentally disturbed that he might not have fit exactly into that bill. He was very intelligent. And I don't know that I could call it arrogance because unfortunately he did turn out to be diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, which is an extremely serious mental illness. But he was convinced that he was God. He would
literally.
Yes.
Okay.
And he, because to him, his name Bell Richard, if it's translated from the French, with Bell meaning beautiful and Richard meaning ruler or all powerful, and he believed he was a beautiful ruler. And unfortunately, at times at night, in particular, he felt that he was God, and he felt he had been brought in front of both of these state judges where the bombs went off for sending these terrible threatening letters to private citizens. And they had put him in jail for it, for these threatening letters. And Bell Richard just could not bear it. And he decided that these 2 judges should be killed. And he proceeded to make these very, very powerful bombs.
Another very intriguing character in the book, Cynthia, George Petkus, is that the proper pronunciation?
Oh, Ron Petkus.
Ron, yeah. Yeah. Gregarious, big old teddy bear of the guy who just happened to have murdered 46 people.
Yes, he was probably the most interesting guy I ever investigated. He was an enforcer for the Hell's Henchmen Outlaw Motorcycle Club. And just to put it in context, at that point, the Hell's Henchmen were merging with the Hell's Angels. Actually, it was the Hell's Angels were moving from California and the West Coast into the Midwest. They wanted to secure a foothold in Chicago. And the Hell's Angels had a clubhouse in Chicago, one in Rockford, Illinois, and one in Gary, Indiana. So they were merging. And Ron Petkus was the enforcer for the henchmen, and he was a giant of a man, about 6'3", 6'4", and 330 pounds or so. And he'd been the enforcer for a long time. And he got caught up in an attempted murder case in which a very successful Chicago criminal defense attorney named Richard Kagan wanted to have his wife murdered. And this Chicago defense attorney, Richard Kagan, had defended Ron Petkus a couple years earlier on an unlawful use of weapons charge and had gotten Petkus off the charge. And when Kagan decided to murder his wife, he thought Ron Petkus is the guy to do it. And he called Ron Petkus up. Petkus went to Kagan's office. Kagan said to Petkus, "I want my wife whacked. How much will you charge me?" Petkus said, $10,000. Kagan said, "Okay." And what was set into motion was a fascinating and lengthy case.
And you know, it's interesting. And one thing I love about your book, Cynthia, is you actually, in that part, you've actually got the transcripts from the trial there. Two people that really came out to me in the book, the slimiest and the bravest, I guess I'll put it that way. You encountered a lot of slimy characters, but the slimiest to me was not a biker or a bomber or a gun smuggler. It was this Richard Kagan fellow.
Oh, yes. I had never worked a case in which everyone, including the other bad guys, all wanted us to catch Richard Kagan. And everyone was willing to cooperate, like I said, including the bad guys, because they knew instinctively, I think, that when we went to them and we said, "Look, we want Kagan, we'll give you a deal, we'll do whatever we have to get this guy," everyone believed us because it was true. But Richard Kagan had everything. He was a successful attorney. He lived in a beautiful house in a suburb of Chicago called Highland Park. And he was the father of Margaret's two daughters. They had two kids together. But he wanted Margaret, his wife, killed because Richard wanted to marry his much younger girlfriend. And Margaret, his wife, was contesting their divorce. And Richard did not want their divorce to go to a divorce trial. And he decided to have Margaret murdered. And really what really made me angry, obviously, it's bad enough to murder Margaret, but Margaret was the mother of his two children, and that really just was over the top to me, and I was going to get him whatever it took.
And that brings me to what I personally believe or took from it was one of the bravest persons you've encountered, his little daughter, Laura.
Yes, absolutely. Laura was 11 years old at the time of the bombing, and by the time the trial rolled around about a year later, Laura was 12 years old, and she had witnessed her father trying to run over her mom with his car. Richard had rented a car and tried to run Margaret over with it, and Laura was in the car at the time. And this adorable little 12-year-old seventh grader took the witness stand against her father, and her father was sitting there at the defense table. And Laura testified against her father, this little girl who looked like she should be in the school play. And she sat on the stand for about 15 minutes. And I thought she was the bravest witness I ever saw in my entire career. And she stood up to the defense attorney, who was not mean to her, but was professionally tough. The defense attorney gave her a hard time within reason. And Laura stood up to her and testified beautifully. And I was so proud of Laura. And I'm happy to say she's now grown up into a beautiful, happily married woman with three children.
Now, Richard Kagan ended up going to prison, which is justice. But I got to tell you, Cynthia, for me, the sweeter justice was the fact that that girlfriend that he wanted to marry after he killed his wife eventually moved in with his former law partner in Arizona, right?
Yes, and I couldn't agree with you more.
We don't love irony. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're talking with Cynthia Beebe, a former ATF agent. When we come back, Cynthia, I want to talk a little bit about some unusual tools in your toolbox that most of us probably never thought about. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're spending some time with Cynthia Beebe. She's got a great book out called Boots in the Ashes that sort of highlights the, oh gosh, some of the cases she worked with over 27 years as an ATF agent, not only an ATF agent, but one of the first female ATF special agents out there on the streets protecting us. Cynthia, quick question. Did you ever cross paths with Jay Dobbins?
Yes, I did. We went to the academy together.
Okay. One of my favorite interviews. Well, up until you came on the show.
Thank you. He was a very nice guy. And in fact, he was a phenomenal athlete. He had played for the Chicago Bears as a wide receiver. And of course, I'm from Chicago and I was a big Bears fan. And he was one of the few guys, he was expected to win Top Gun, as a matter of fact, when I won. And he was one of the first guys to come up and congratulate me. And he's just a prince of a man.
He is. He is. He's coaching coaching young people now and just a terrific guy. Cynthia, one of the other things that kind of struck me in reading your book, I remember the case of where, you know, to get Al Capone, we finally got him on tax evasion, not all the other stuff. It was interesting to me, you know, Bell Richard, bomber, mm-hmm. tried to kill two judges, hurt a lot of people, but you really ended up getting him on mailing the threatening letters initially.
Correct. That's one reason that I felt we could make the case right away. His case belonged in federal court, not state court, and I knew that within seconds, because you cannot mail a threatening letter through the United States mail. That is a federal crime if you threaten to kill or harm someone. And these letters and postcards that he wrote, he was very smart. He believed in the First Amendment. He would argue the First Amendment with you till the cows came home. But some of these letters were just over the top. They threatened to kill people. And, of course, again, being from Chicago, I was familiar with Al Capone. He did not go to prison for murder or for shooting people. He went to prison for tax evasion. And I knew right away with Bell Richard, he might not go to prison for the bombings because there was no physical evidence tying Bell Richard to the scene. But he could go, and I thought would go to prison, for mailing threatening letters. And that is exactly what happened. He was found not guilty of the bombings, but he was found guilty on 5 counts of mailing threatening letters. And he spent almost a decade in federal prison.
And at the end of the day, as long as they're behind bars, right?
Yes, because I and everyone else at the FBI Behavioral Academy believed without a doubt he would set more bombs.
Now, Cynthia, go ahead and finish your thought.
Just that we all believed he was a very dangerous man on the streets. That's all.
And I tell you, one of the other ones you mentioned that, and I think you actually said it's a magnet for local police departments, felon in possession of a firearm, one of your most important tools?
Oh, yes. Felon in possession used to be, you could, a bad guy, if the record was long enough, could get up to 5 years. Now they can get up to 10 years. But one of the worst guys I ever worked was in Minneapolis. He also was a Hell's Angel. He had committed an extremely brutal murder in Minneapolis, but the Minneapolis PD were having a hard time pinning the murder on him. But he was also a felon, and he had, around that same time, had been arrested with a gun. And I was friends with the Minneapolis coppers, and they came to me and they said, look, we're having a hard time making this first degree murder case, but can you get him on the felon in possession and put him away for 5 years? And I said, yes. And we went to Jeff, my friend, ATF agent, and I went to interview this guy, George. He admitted to possession of the gun. He also unwittingly gave us additional information on the murder. We indicted him for felon in possession, and we were ready to arrest him on felon in possession. And right at that time, happily, the Minneapolis PD was able to make the first degree murder case on him. And he was found guilty. I testified at the murder trial, and he went to prison for 30 or 31 years, I believe.
Cynthia, a technique, and I was a criminal justice major. Actually, I went to school at the same time. Jay Dobbins was one of my classmates. But I have never heard of this technique and wonder why they don't use it more often. Dial a pinch.
Yes. Dial a pinch was one of my favorite stories of all time. I worked with a wonderful agent when I first came on the job. He was, older, which to that point meant maybe he was about 50, and I was well under 30. And he was an ATF agent up in North Dakota, which is a gigantic and fairly empty state. And he was the nicest guy in the world, but he did not want to have to drive, you know, 8 hours in one direction, arrest a guy, and have to drive that guy 8 hours back to bring him to the federal courthouse in North Dakota, which was on the southeastern edge of the state. So his name was John, and John would call up bad guys who there were indictments out for them. They were violent crimes, but they weren't particularly violent crimes. They were, for example, a felon in possession, but perhaps it was one count, and the bad guy was not a, you know, someone to be feared necessarily. And I think his name was Brian in the book, but at any rate, Brian would call him up and he would say, "Listen, I have a warrant for your arrest, and I am going to give you a chance to drive yourself down here to federal court and show up in front of the judge on this date at this time, and I won't come out there and put the cuffs on you and drive you back. Do you agree to that?" And these guys, you know, all agreed to it, and Brian would say, and Brian was the nicest guy on the planet. So when he would say, "Now listen, if you don't show up, I'm going to come out there and kick the shit out of you," and, you know, people believed him. But what made me laugh was he really was just the nicest guy, and I don't know that he would ever have done that. But every single time it worked. Every single time Brian did dial a pinch, the bad guy showed up in court at the right time, and he never had to go out there and snag somebody.
Cynthia, we're back to the long story short part, so we need to be real quick. I'm not forgetting about Jeff. One of the other pieces of advice that he gave you deals with your Secret Service protection. Really, real quick, explain to us why his advice, always get the kitchen, made sense.
Okay. Jeff was a good-sized fellow, and he liked to eat very much. And when I came on the job, ATF would supplement the Secret Service. For about a decade, I would work Secret Service details. And sometimes on Secret Service details, you could be assigned to a post and spend literally hours out there at the post, and, you know, not be given anything to eat. And Jeff was a good eater, and he really did like me very much. And he said, "Now listen, Cindy, when you get on an assignment, Secret Service assignment, you always ask the Secret Service supervisor for the kitchen, because that way the kitchen staff loves the Secret Service, and they love to feed them good food. And that way you will never go hungry." And Jeff was right, and I always tried to get the kitchen.
Cynthia, you've been just a terrific interview. I want to remind folks again, the book is Boots in the Ashes. About a minute left. What advice would you give to other young women who want to follow in your boots and continue to kick down those barriers?
I would say to, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but work hard. And once you're hired, particularly, you know, find your area of interest. It might be guns. It might be bombs, whatever, and listen to the more experienced agents who you trust, study hard, also listen to the prosecutors. You will go nowhere without working with prosecutors. In fact, that was one of the keys to the book, and one of the keys to my success was I was able to work well with prosecutors. So listen to people as to how the system works, and once you understand how the system works, then you can build good cases. You'll know what evidence is. You'll know if you don't have enough evidence, and you'll know how to obtain it. So always look for the evidence.
Cynthia, thank you so much for your time and sharing your story with our American Warrior Radio listeners.
Thank you very much for having me, Ben.
This podcast and others can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Also, check out Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio to support our mission. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.